Welcome everybody. As you just heard, I was visiting Olympia yesterday and gave a talk at Evergreen University. Hopefully I'm not going to repeat the same talk. Especially there are a few people who attended the talk last night and now you're here. And it would be nice if I can say something new that I haven't said last night, but there's no guarantee. And then there are many of you who weren't there last night. So anyway, it's really nice to be here again. Last night, the crowd was very young. There are many young people. I do not mean that you are not young. They were saying that the 60 is the new 40, so I guess you're all young. So they're really, really young people last night, like in their 20s and 30s, and perhaps you are noticing that there's kind of big cultural change has been happening in the last few decades, as you witnessed, and many of the young people are becoming more and more secular, less religious, which is neither good nor bad. This is where we are going as a culture. And usually when I travel and give talks like this, not too many young people come to my talks. One point, when I look around, I was actually the youngest person, even though I was the speaker. And then I look around, everybody's older than me and wondering what's happening in this world. But that is changing, not because we are getting more younger people, but I'm getting older. But they're really young people yesterday, but they impressed me in many levels. They're open-hearted, they're courageous. Also, one of the teachers, her name is Cynthia, has been introducing some of my writings, my first book, No Self, No Problem, to her students. The whole class has been reading my first book, and the students really immersed themselves into this book. And they even had a lot of questions. And they wrote all these questions together and sent it to my organization. And then they gave it to me on the way to airport in San Francisco, which gave me a chance to read these questions and have some answers. But these questions are also very moving. And then when I finished the talk last night, there was a long greeting line where all these suddenly young people showed up and they had so many questions. It's almost some of them really want to have a long dialogue with me. But their questions are also extraordinary. And in the end, the conclusion is that many of them have an amazing heart and they wanted to wake up and they want to also live consciously and to bring about wisdom, insight, compassion in their everyday life. Not only they wanted to change their consciousness, but they want to be a force of a change in this world and to the humanity. talking with them was extremely encouraging, since these are the young people who are going to inherit this world, and they are going to be the guardian of this human world. They have lots of influence for the future world. And many of them really asked me about ego and personal self, whether there's personal self or not, what is the role of the ego. And these are, of course, very profound reflections that many people even don't touch. And therefore, I would like to talk about these topics, about the role of ego in our everyday life, and also personal self, whether it's real or not. And these are really profound reflections that many people do have resistance to even open these topics, because it's kind of inconvenient in many ways. Even lots of spiritual meditators don't want to talk about these topics, because maybe it sounds too abstract or too profound or too this and that. But eventually we would like to start contemplating or even asking those questions. And the ego is a very important part of our own existence. We would not actually survive without ego, so ego is not a bad thing. In the Tibetan tradition, we often teach and that all our problems in this life springs from the ego grasping, which is called the dakzen. Dak means ego, selfzen means grasping. And then we developed all kinds of reflections, methodology, like tantric Buddhist practices. These really powerful methods, skillful means applied to transcend, to cut through the ego grasping. So as a culture, as a Buddhist culture in Tibet, we are very much taught for centuries that all our problem comes from the ego grasping. And that's why even ordinary people in my culture do have this kind of cultural, almost inborn insight that they have to look into their ego. They know their ego is the problem. Even though they don't do anything with their ego, they may cherish ego completely, but they kind of know deep down somewhere, because this is a kind of cultural wisdom that has been inherited. And then there are cultures where there's no even slightest awareness that there's something wrong with having ego, especially when you are not very aware of that, when you are totally ruled by it. A friend of mine, his name is Maman Tarshin Rinpoche, who passed away 10 years ago, oh, not 10 years ago, sorry, 4 or 5 years ago. He used to come to Seattle and taught. He's a very wonderful teacher, a dear friend of mine. And he was also yogi, Tibetan yogi, with a top-notch, a great master of rituals and ceremonies. And he speaks very simple English language. And one time he told me that he was teaching somewhere, most probably in the United States. And his whole teaching was about going beyond ego grasping, which is a direct translation of Tibetan word of dancing. Towards the end of the teaching, this group of people approached him and said, "You have been talking about transcending evil guest pain. What is that all about?" Evil guest pain. So they even didn't hear what he was saying, because maybe, of course, something has to do with his mispronunciation of it, you know, English. But I think there's more than that. There's some kind of psychological resistance really to hear what he is saying. Maybe there are cultures where they don't have even some kind of reference point where that maybe there's something wrong when we're totally ruled by our own ego, when we don't bring awareness, self-reflection to our own mind, and to recognize our ego, and to even admit that we have ego. So it's very dangerous when we don't have any kind of self-awareness, recognizing our ego, and also recognizing our inner poisons, recognizing our own neurotic tendencies, which we all have. It can be very dangerous. And if the whole culture is lacking in it, and that culture can create lots of a problem on itself, in the same way, when an individual is lacking in that awareness, then that individual tend to go through lots of unnecessary misery in this incarnation. And therefore, in my tradition, really very first thing they teach is not even meditation. In my culture, they teach two things. And one of the things they teach is this mantra. Everybody learns this mantra before they learn how to curse. This is kind of amazing, isn't it? I don't know whether this is true in other cultures, but in the, of course, we do have lots of curses, by the way. I'm not saying that. Tibetan language is very pure. Last year, we took around 40 people to do this intensive Tibetan Vajrayana retreat in the Canyon Dish in Arizona. And you have to go through with the Navajo people because it's a part of the reservation. You have to hire them and they will guide into the canyon. We camped out for almost 8 days, and there are lots of bears. They will be visiting you, and it's kind of a little bit challenging. And then we did this very intensive Tibetan Vajrayana practice. And then when we come out, the person who gave me a ride said that in this net cultures, they don't have a curse. They don't have a curse. They don't even swear. And she said, is that true? That must be true also in Tibetan culture, because Tibetan Tibet is such a spiritual country. I said, well, sorry that I have to somehow destroy your beautiful illusion about my culture. We have lots of curses. And more than any other language that I have known. For some reason, but then that's not what they teach. First time when you're a little child, they teach you this one mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, has 6 syllables. It is the name of Avalokiteshvara, very similar to Kuan Yin. Many of you are familiar with the Kuan Yin. Even though in Buddhism, we don't have a theistic tradition, we don't really teach that divine reside outside, Avalokiteshvara or Kuan Yin or Dara are taught as a sacred presentation of our inner goodness, our inner divinity, our inner strength, our inner wisdom. And so everybody learn how to recite this mantra even at very early age before they teach other language. So this mantra is very much deeply rooted in the consciousness of my culture. When people get scared or when people feel confused, naturally the first thing they do is recite this mantra in my culture, which is, I think, wonderful way of dealing with the troubles that we go through everyday life in this human world. And then another thing to teach is that to look inside and to recognize one's on ego, and not to let yourself be completely ruled, not let you be unconscious by ego, but to be aware of it, and knowing also not to act under the power of our own ego. But the ego itself is just a part of our on a survival system, we need that. Just like we need hands, we need the brain, we need these inner organs in order to survive as a human being. There's nothing wrong with having ego. Also, sometimes we joke about ego. I actually often say that not only that we can have an ego, but we can maybe turn our ego into our servant, not let it be our master or lord. So maybe you can use our ego. So ego will work for you very hard. Ego will say, well, you need a health insurance. Let me work for you. I don't know, yeah. So you need this and that. So ego is actually very useful. So we have to be okay with having the ego, but not let it be the master who rules us, who rules our heart, who rules our consciousness. And the ego is this sense that we are individual and we are separate from everything else. This is what ego is, and almost every human being has an ego, no matter how wonderful, how evolved you are, everybody has their own ego structure. And then, and when you look into that ego structure, and there are actually a lot of very powerful impulses. And in the Buddhism, these are called the three poisons, which are the greed, hatred, and the delusion. And then also we said that the two most powerful impulses as a basic structure of our ego are actually aversion and attraction. Something we can all relate to. And you see that we are actually living every day and we're responding, we are reacting to the outer situations as well as in relationship to our inner experiences, our thought emotions, from these two basic impulses, attraction and aversion. We experience this all the time. Attraction is that your desire to hold on to, your desire to acquire, your desire to engage with. And then aversion is your desire to run away from something, or desire to destroy, desire to escape from something. That might be a situation. And also, among some neurotic tendencies that our ego has. You don't have any neurotic tendencies, don't worry. Don't take this personally. I'm not really talking about you. I'm talking about ego, right? So we are totally okay. So we are all fine, we are totally perfect. So I'm just talking about the ego, our ego, so we don't have to take it personally. So among many neurotic tendencies, one of the powerful neurotic tendency of ego is that it's always reacting. It's always reacting from hope and fear, from aversion and from attraction. It's always reacting to a situation that we run into everyday life, as well as also in relationship to our inner experiences, like thoughts, feelings, and emotions. And therefore, if we really want to wake up, whatever that means, I think we all have also very strong desire to wake up. That's very powerful impulse in each of us. Just like the last night, the students really shared their strong impulse, strong aspiration to wake up. It's so inspiring. In the same way, you all have this very strong aspiration to wake up spiritually. This is why you're here tonight. There are no other reasons, no other actually incentives that brought you here tonight, except we are all feeling this burning desire somehow or another to wake up and to change who we are, to change our heart and to mind for the better. And then somehow I am happen to be here tonight. Really, this gathering has nothing to do with me or I have something to say. It's just that I happen to be here tonight. But what brought all of us together is that our burning desire. Our burning desire to wake up. Our burning desire to truly expand our heart and to expand our mind. And to expand our consciousness. Albert Einstein, he said something that Buddha might have said. And he said that the vocation of a human existence is actually to expand the circle of love and compassion towards all creatures. So this is a really beautiful, beautiful statement that he made. Let me repeat this. The vocation of a human life, this existence, is to expand, to keep expanding the circle of love and compassion towards all creatures. How amazing it is. And of course, this is all we need to do in the end in this human incarnation. So we have this amazing aspiration burning inside, the desire to wake up, desire to expand the circle of love and compassion, or to expand our consciousness, depend on the which expression you might use. When I said that, you will totally understand what I'm trying to say. Maybe you'll be even nodding your head somehow or another. You're right, I have been feeling this desire for a long time. You're right, I do have this burning desire to wake up. I do have this burning desire to change my mind and heart or to expand the circle of love and compassion towards all living beings. I also telling them bumper sticker around this very topic. Bumper sticker. Perhaps there are lots of wonderful bumper stickers you can share with me, but one of my favorite bumper sticker is a gut bodhicitta. Like gut milk. And this bumper sticker was very popular a few years ago in Bay Area where I live these days, and sometimes I will ride a car with somebody to get to the airport, and then there are a lot of times that you don't know what to do with, and there are many ways that you can entertain yourself. One of them is to look around and to read everybody's bumper sticker, and one of them is a Gautam Bodhicitta. And it's such a wonderful reminder. Bodhicitta means, in the Buddhist tradition, the awakened heart, which is actually your aspiration to wake up and to literally expand the circle of your heart, your love and compassion towards all living beings without any exclusion. I think the way we can really change ourselves, truly, if this is what we want, if we really want to change our consciousness, then we have to look inside and to look into our own psyche and to recognize our own ego as well. The truth is that in some sense every human being wants to wake up, every human being wants to change their consciousness if they have the opportunity, if they have the means. We human beings are naturally spiritual. It's not like that eventually we come to some kind of moment after meditating a long time and thinking that, oh, now I'm enlightened, I don't have to change myself anymore. That would never happen. And also, if our heart is clear, we all want to change. We really want to change our consciousness. Especially if our heart is clear, our mind is a person, that's what we want. Of course, this is not like a desire that is always happening in your heart sometimes. It's not like that you are always feeling this desire, oh, I want to change my consciousness, I want to wake up. And this is not a desire that is happening in your mind all time in everyday life, unless you live in monastery and you're waking up early morning and reciting all these prayers that remind you and that even help you to invoke and rekindle that divine desire every day. In my tradition, we have a set of liturgies that we are asked to do every day, and these liturgies are called jandon in my language. Jal means it's kind of honorific word, but it means also mouth or don means to recite. It means sacred liturgies. And sometimes these yogis in my culture would get up very early in the morning and they will recite a whole body of sacred literatures. And each of those literatures are designed as a method to invoke something sublime in each of us. Some liturgy would invoke love, another liturgy will invoke compassion or devotion or awareness. And then there are liturgies such as the Bodhisattva's vows. When you recite the Bodhisattva's vows, Bodhisattva, the awakened heroine, and you feel once again that you are rekindling your desire to wake up and to change your consciousness and to expand circle of love and compassion towards all living beings. And then if really somebody asks you, if you just ask yourself, do I really want to change? Do I really want to change my consciousness? Of course, always the answer is a yes. You always would get the same answer from deepest place inside yourself. The answer is, I want to change myself, my consciousness, my heart. You will never get answer by saying, I don't want to change myself. I don't want to change my consciousness. I'm happy with my consciousness as it is. I don't want to change my heart. My heart is very closed, but I'm going to stay with that rest of my life. Yeah, I know my consciousness really, really closed, very narrow, but I'm not going to change it. I know my consciousness is filled with the delusions and all these concepts, ideas, but I'm not going to change. I'm going to stay with it, I'm happy with everything. So actually such answer will never arise from your heart when you really consult with yourself. I think we all had religious experiences sometime in our life. Personally, I'm a very ordinary person, but I have had many religious experiences in my life. I'm going to talk about some of them. I have had religious experiences when I go to temples, because I was a monk for a very long time. Now I'm a householder, but I was a monk for many, many years in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And the reason I went to monastery is not because I was forced by my parents or my relatives. As a young boy, I was very zealous, a little bit too much. Like, was very religious for some reason, who knows how I end up being so religious at an early age. I grew up in a village that had around 7 or 8 families. All my friends, these young boys, were not religious, they're a little bit mischievous. And I end up being very, very religious. Maybe I inherit some kind of religious DNA. And all I wanted was to go to monastery for some reason. And then my wishes are answered, as they say, be careful what you wish for. So I went to monastery and didn't learn any skills for my survival, but I'm okay, I'm surviving happily these days, but I didn't learn any skills. Sometimes I had this kind of regret, oh, wish I went to some regular school so I would have a real job, I would have a career. You know, I would have some kind of skills. And I don't have any skills in my life because I spent all those years in the monastery and reading scriptures. Kind of very wonderful. Wonderful when you tell people your life. They say, oh, that's really great. But I said, it's not really that great. People think it's some kind of romance. Oh, you went to monastery at an early age because most people in this culture never went to monastery. So when I fly on the aeroplane, sometimes people get very bored and they won't talk to me. They say, what do you do? And then I end up telling all my life story, tell them I'm from Tibet, I went to monastery. They said, oh, amazing. It's like, sounds so romantic. But I said, it's not that romantic. And especially, you know, when you're young, you don't have to worry about your life. And also, monastery were a bunch of freeloaders. To be monk means to be freeloader, to be holy freeloader. So you don't have to work. All these devotees come and they feed you. So you really don't think about life. You think, oh, this is how you're going to live the rest of your life. And you kind of change your mind. You're realizing that you really don't like to stuck with this freeloader the rest of your life, and also you feel the monastery is a little bit too small for you, and then you go outside in the world and you realize that you don't have any skills. Does this make sense? So the point is, I was very, very religious, really like very zealous and serious, like felt that the people around me are not religious enough. I was kind of looking around, these people are not holy enough, like that. So you know how difficult it perhaps to be around me when I was very young. And then I went to monastery and become monk. I stayed monk for many, many years. Then I quit such lifestyle, become householder. And so the point is, what I'm trying to say is that we had to read all these liturgies every morning, and I still continued reciting those liturgies. And often I think, as a humor, they can take monastery, they can take me out of the monastery, but nobody can take monastery outside of me. So does this make sense? So actually, outside I'm not monk, but inside I feel that I'm always monk, no matter how much I try not to be monk, but there's a monkishness inside me, and there's monastery inside me that I never can get rid of it. And therefore, I read lots of sacred liturgies, but I go to temples and I meditate. I have had this religious experience all the time at early age, and even today when I go to even Buddhist temples, when I sit, I feel this very powerful feeling rise inside me, so powerful, stronger than many of those ordinary feelings, desires like that. and feel it can be so easily activated simply by visiting temple, seeing something, image of Buddha. But my religious experience is nothing holy in itself. It's just my desire to change my consciousness. It's not like that I feel I'm enlightened or I have suddenly all these divine visions. Instead, my religious experience is like this sense that I really want to change who I am. I want to change my consciousness. When I visit a temple, when I read sacred scriptures, the feeling, the religious feeling that arises in me is that I really want to change myself. I really want to change my consciousness. And you all have this amazing impulse as a human being. We are spiritual. The moment you are born, we are all spiritual equally. We all have this impulse, but somehow through your upbringing or our cultural conditionings, and sometimes many people actually live a life in which that they don't run into some circumstances, or they don't actually run into catalysts from outside that allow them to be in touch with that experience and to even cultivate it. And so, and that part of themselves is completely covered and veiled by all these other ordinary desires, like desire for this and that, more like ordinary desires, which nothing wrong with that. Desire for security, desire for certainty, desire for worldly success, and so forth. So, and the point I'm trying to make is that once we have that aspiration, the first really step that we need to take is really to look inside and to simply recognize our own ego. And this can be, of course, lifelong and journey. Last year, there is a Buddhist organization called Abhaya Fellowship who organized this wonderful panel discussion where we invited some of our wonderful friends like Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg, and Norman Fisher. I saw the picture of Norman Fisher over there, wonderful Zen teacher. And somehow they invited me. I think they made a mistake. And above all, they invited Kambo Tsurum Loru, very beloved Dharma teacher in Tibet, who is the main abbot of the Larung Monastery that hosts 10,000 monks, nuns. And then each of us had a chance to present, but the panel was titled as Change Your Mind and Change the World. And so we all shared our own thoughts on that topic. How can we change the world? By changing our own mind. And then after we all shared our thoughts, our wonderful friend Jack Kornfield looked at him, Kambo Tsurum Loru, through interpreter, and asked him, so would you mind to synthesize everything that we have been speaking to now into one essential message? Of course, he didn't say that exactly word by word, but that's what he pretty much said. And then Kambo Tsurum Loru said just briefly, and then he said, you are all saying that the way to change our mind is to look inside, to look at our mind, to look inside. That's really what meditation is. That's really what mindfulness meditation is in the end. The depth of mindfulness is to always look inside. But we do have a collective resistance to the enlightenment. And we have to acknowledge it. We do have a common and shared resistance to enlightenment. And that is inside me. I'm not saying, oh, I don't have it. Even I can see a very strong resistance to enlightenment. And we all share that. We are kind of a little bit a living paradox. On the one hand, we have this bodhicitta aspiration to wake up, to change our consciousness. But on the other hand, we have very strong resistance, almost a neurological, biological, evolutionary, karmic level resistance to the awakening and to the freedom, which is kind of very contradicting. Does this sound? But we cannot take that personally. It's just part of the evolutionary process. We don't know what is going to happen with the next 3,000 years. We don't know. Hopefully there will be human beings on the planet by then. Maybe if we can save this planet, imagine that humanity will still live and 3,000 years from now on, it would be very different kind of species. Perhaps lots of the problems that we're dealing with would be gone. Hopefully there are no racism, hopefully there are no xenophobia, and hopefully there are no prejudice. You know, hopefully inequality are gone by then. I'm sure there will be new problems, who knows. But there won't be perhaps problems that we are dealing with right now. So kind of basic level, like we are against those problems in a very real way every day these days. And maybe by then the humanity would be so evolved, maybe this kind of resistance will be gone. Who knows? Of course, this is a wild, totally wild assumption. I even don't know what I'm talking about. You know, my mind tends to go everywhere, like, am I talking about some kind of science fiction movie plot? But you see, throughout human history, there are this kind of very evolutionary, collective, karmic level resistance to the awakening, to the goodness, to the uprightness. And then as time goes by, they have been falling apart, but still there are so many layers of resistance to fall apart. Let's talk about caste system. Let's talk about caste system that exists in India, and to a certain extent, the caste system exists in the history of this country. And you know that throughout history, when somebody spoke against it, like Buddha spoke against the caste system, but you know that he drew so much anger and so much resistance, like wrath from the society, from the establishment, not just from few people, from even the religious establishment. And they were so upset when Buddha said, oh, there are no caste system, is all just based on the ignorance. That's what Buddha said. All human beings are equal. He made this very famous statement, in my Sangha, caste is not important. Your ethnicity is not important. What matters is the Dharma training, Lappa in Tibetan. That's how we say. In Sanskrit, I think Vinaya. That's what matters. So Buddha transcend, but you know, it wasn't easy for Buddha to say that and do a lot of resistance. And then even when we look into this country, and finally there was enough love, compassion, enough wisdom that we realize that like slavery system, which is a form of a caste system, is not a holy. It's actually very way of losing, taking somebody else's dignity, but also way of losing our own dignity. But you know, it took so long time to overcome that resistance that's shared by so many, and even still you may find the remnants of that, the resistance is here in this culture. So, and then finally we drop one resistance, whatever that is, resistant to maybe equality, resistant to peace, world peace, resistant to uniting humanity as one family. And then just like that, one of, I think, our powerful resistance that we're dealing with is a resistance to the enlightenment, awakening. And this resistance is not actually personal, but it's a universal. It's a, in each of us because of the time that we are living in and the maybe map of a whole the evolutionary process. And that's why this resistance to the enlightenment often manifests in our resistance to look inside. And many people don't want to look inside. Actually, the world will be changed if more people look inside. Imagine that the 99% of the world wake up every morning and look inside. The world will be very different. Imagine some of these politicians wake up every early morning, and before they say anything, if they spend even 5 minutes on the meditation cushion and look into their mind, the world would be changed. We'll be living in a very different world. Maybe kinder world that has more dignity. But it sounds like lots of politicians, powerful people actually don't sit even for 5 minutes. I could be wrong. It seems that they seem to be so intelligent, powerful, but the one thing they are not capable of is just to sit for 5 minutes and to look in silence in their mind and into their ego. This is the reason we don't have too many people in the world who want to meditate, who want to look inside. I also heard besides that we all do have a karmic and collective resistance to awakening, but there are also psychological factors why we don't want to look inside. The psychologist said that as a human being we are afraid of three things terribly. One of them is a death, which totally makes sense. We're all afraid of death. Another one that they're really afraid of people. That's kind of disconcerting, isn't it? We're actually afraid of people. And another one that they're really afraid of is our own mind. You know, that's why we're really afraid of mind, because if we look inside and really, really look at our mind, we don't know what we are going to find out. Anxiety and self-loathing, you see, worry, anger, maybe we feel there not so much to look inside. Maybe we feel we are sticking our head into garbage can when we look inside. Who wants to do that? Oh, that's enough, you see. The meditators are going to do that. They're going to stick their head into the garbage can. Actually, I had that experience for a long time. I started meditating very intensively at one point, but I had all these romantic, naive ideas of meditation. I thought, oh, when I meditate, I'm going to be so happy. Maybe, who knows, some third eye will be open. I really had all these kind of romantic ideas. Maybe I will see the visions, divine visions, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas will come to me and they will teach me, they will bless me. Maybe I can travel to some mystical kingdoms in my meditation where everything's totally sacred. And that was actually my kind of idea about meditation when I was very young. Then when I started to meditate, in two senses, it turned out to be totally opposite. And I felt, when I'm going to get over this? Hope this is going to be for a while then. Like really, really felt I'm just meditation wasn't very fun, but I knew I have to do it, even though I didn't like it. I didn't like to see what has happened in my mind, worry, anxiety. I found my mind is a grouchy all the time. But things are getting better these days. That's some improvement that I can report to all of you, you see. So this is the reason why people don't want to sit. They don't really want to look at their mind. And also when people see these things, unless you're trained to meditate, people don't know how to handle the things. As a meditator, many of you have been meditating, we kind of know how to handle them. We know how to witness them, how to watch them, learning not to identify them. We can remind ourselves they are transient, they are not who we are, don't worry. But most people never taught these tactics. So suddenly, if they look inside, they see all these things are quite actually unenchanting. And they don't know what to do with anxiety. Somebody told me that a scientist did this experiment. They created an empty room, removed everything, TV, snack, no magazine, totally empty, completely like barren empty room, except a chair. But they designed chair in a way that there are lots of buttons. You push this button, you get electric shock. And they invite all these volunteers to sit there. And so they had two choices. One choice, just sit there, do nothing, because there's nothing there in that room. No TV, no entertainment, nobody to talk, no magazine. They had to leave perhaps cell phones outside. You just have to sit in totally empty room. So they found that most people prefer to push that button to get electric shock rather than sitting there without doing anything. And because maybe when you sit, when you're not distracting yourself with them, these things come out, you know. Worry, fear, self-criticism, self-loathing, and people don't know what to do. So there are lots of reasons why we human beings are not very comfortable to look inside, even though that turned out to be really the secret for awakening, for inner freedom. Thank you so much, everybody, and thank you. Now we'll chant a mantra together. This is a Buddhist mantra known as the mantra of Paranjana Paramita, transcendent wisdom. And the mantra goes, Om Gatte Gatte Parangatte Parasamgatte Bodhisvaha, means gone beyond completely. What awakening. Quite amazing, isn't it? And we'll chant 10 times. Please join me. There's a melody, very simple to follow. Om Gatte Gatte Parangatte Parasamgatte Bodhisvaha 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 Om Gatte Gatte Parangatte Bodhin Svaha Om Gatin Gatin Paran Gatin Paran Sam Gatte Bodhin Svaha Om Gatte Gatte Thank you, everybody, for your presence. Thank you to the Insight Meditation Center for inviting all of us.